So we're looking at the Ten Commandments. Exodus chapter 20. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, "You speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us lest we die." Moses said to the people, "Do not fear. For God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." The people stood far off, while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. Now tonight, I want us to start thinking about the eighth commandment. You shall not steal. I'm sure we all know what this commandment means, at least in general terms. You shall not take what is not yours. You shall not take for yourself what does not belong to you. Those are simple definitions. But I hope that tonight we can dig a little deeper. We need to ask some important questions. Start with the way I've just explained the commandment. You shall not steal. You shall not take for yourself what does not belong to you. Now, when I give you that definition, I'm assuming something. I'm assuming that there are some things that belong to me, and there are some things that do not. I'm assuming that I have the right to call some things my own. In other words, I'm assuming the right of property. I'm saying that a human being can legitimately own property. That a human being can say, this is mine and it's not yours. Of course, as believers, we will say that all our property ultimately belongs to God, and that we are merely the stewards of our property, but we still speak of it as our property or my property. Now, I think I'm sure we all live from day to day with that assumption. You assume that your car belongs to you, and that other people don't have the right just to drive off in it. And you assume that your clothes are your own, and if somebody walks into your home and rifles through your wardrobe and then walks off wearing your favourite shirt, he's done something wrong. We assume that a man can buy a house and call it his, or that a group of people together can buy a building like this and say it belongs to us. That's taken for granted, isn't it, by everyone? Answer, no. There are people who don't take it for granted. There have been philosophers and economists and politicians who have denied that there is any right to own property. One of the most famous was a French philosopher and politician called Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who was born in 1805 and died in 1865. Proudhon's most famous statement was simply this: all property is theft. Do you understand what he meant by that? He was saying that if you dare to say about anything, this is mine, well, you're depriving everybody else of the use of it. And that's theft. They've got as much right to it as you have. In other words, he was denying any right for anyone to hold property. Proudhon had a profound influence on Karl Marx. Marx didn't agree with Proudhon completely, but he did absorb that basic idea from Proudhon, that as far as possible, no one should hold property as theirs. All assets should be owned by the state or the community. I shouldn't have a house that I can call mine. I should live in a house provided for me by the state. No one should be allowed to own a factory. It should be owned by everyone. A pure communist system is based on the idea that all assets should be there for the benefit of everyone. If we talk about a commune, we're talking about a group of people who have decided that they're not going to hold any personal property. The land is there for all of them. The crops that grow on it belong to all of them. The houses are shared by everyone. In some cases, all the children born within the commune are counted as belonging to the whole group. The communist dream was that that system could work not just for 100 people, but for a whole nation, and ultimately for the whole global population. Now let me repeat, nobody has actually ever put Proudhon's theory into action consistently. If you look at a photograph of the man, you'll see that he's wearing glasses. And I'm sure that he didn't think his glasses belonged to the whole community. If someone had walked over to him and said, well, it's my turn to wear them now, I'm sure he'd have refused. Likewise with his boots and his clothes. But in principle, he was one of a group of philosophers who persuaded many people that the idea of owning property was a wrong idea. Folk who listened to him and to other philosophers like him took on board the idea that people should be discouraged from aiming to acquire and own property. People should be discouraged from ever thinking of property as their own. And that thought, that outlook has filtered through to many people today. People who have never heard of Proudhon, who have never read a word of Marx, still have been influenced by their thinking. In fact, at one level or another, it's influenced the ideals and the practice of just about every Western society. So before we talk about what the Eighth Commandment means for us personally, I think we first need to ask, does anyone have the right to own property? And if so, where does that right come from? And as always, we've got to start in the first book of the Bible. We've got to go to Genesis, and we've got to learn there about God himself. At the beginning of this series on the Ten Commandments, we went through the account of how God created the world. And one of the things that's most obvious in that account is that God worked. He created the universe out of nothing. But then, step by step, he worked to mold it into what he wanted it to be. He divided one thing from another, the light from the darkness, the dry land from the sea, the waters above from the waters beneath. He put the stars in place, and the moon and the sun. He made plants grow out of the earth, and he made the earth bring forth living creatures. And then he made mankind. First he took some of the soil, and he shaped it into the form of the first man. He breathed into that lifeless form, and the man became a living creature. And then he took a rib from the man, and from that rib he shaped the first woman. At every point the Lord was working. And on the seventh day we're told he rested from all the work that he had done. God works. He works by choice. He didn't need to create a universe at all. He was perfectly self-sufficient in his eternal triune being. But he chose to create. He chose to work. Now, we spent in the course of this series quite a lot of time thinking about the way that God created human beings and what human beings were intended to be. Let me read words again that we've read lots of times before. This is Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Man was created in the image of God. Both male and female were created to be like God. And one of the ways that human beings are supposed to be like God is that they work. Adam and Eve were supposed to take charge of the fish of the sea, and the birds of the heavens, and the livestock, and the whole earth. They were supposed to exercise dominion over them. Well, that meant work, didn't it? It meant serious work. Even to get to know all the creatures on earth would be a hugely demanding task, let alone working out what was best for each creature and allocating each one its own role. But that was God's plan. If human beings were going to be in God's image, it meant that they had to work. And that's exactly what God tells them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." That's what God commanded. They were to multiply and they were to fill the earth and they were to subdue it. In other words, they had to bring it under control and develop its potential. We thought a few weeks back about that the huge variety of jobs that would be involved in doing that. Adam and Eve and their children would have to build ships to cross the seas. And they'd have to build bridges to span the rivers. And they'd plant vineyards and orchards and wheat fields. And they'd mine precious metals and shape them into beautiful things. They were told to subdue the earth. God wanted them to work. Human beings are designed to work. In order to be whole, in order to be healthy physically and psychologically, in order to be God's image bearers, they have to work. And then God said this to Adam and Eve. This is chapter 1, verse 29. "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that's on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food." So God says, "I'm going to provide food for you. Lots of different foods, all delightful. I'm giving them to you," says God. But did that mean that all the fruit would just fall into their lap? Could they just lie there all day under one of the trees in the Garden of Eden and wait for the different fruit to drop into their hammock? No, this is what we read in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and tend it." Before they set off to subdue the rest of the earth, they first had to make a start by learning to care for that garden. They had to work there where God had put them. And what they learned working in the garden that God had planted for them, they could then use to develop the rest of the earth. God's plan was always, even before the fall, that human beings would enjoy good things, but that they would have to work for them. There were no free lunches, even in the Garden of Eden. The work would be satisfying, it would be delightful, it would be creative, but it would still be work. That was part of what it meant for them to be in God's image. But take that a step further. When God, by his work, created and shaped the world, the earth, who did it belong to? It belonged to him. That's something that's said again and again in the Bible. The earth is his, for he made it. Just because he put that work into it, he could say, "It's mine. I have brought this into being." And that too is part of being in God's image. That we are able to say, "What I have worked to produce belongs to me." Now, as you know, that happy time in the Garden of Eden came to an end. It came to an end when Adam and Eve disobeyed the command that God gave to them. the serpent came and told his subtle lies. If you take the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will be like God himself, knowing good and evil. The serpent said to them, there's one way you can get instant knowledge, comprehensive wisdom, and you don't have to work for it. God wanted them to be wise, but they were going to learn wisdom step by step, through working at the tasks that God had given them to do, through listening to God's own voice. But now the serpent says, there's an easy way of bypassing all that work, of jumping right to the finishing line. And so they took the fruit and they ate it. And immediately something died within them. They died. Immediately they found that they were cut off from the life of God himself. Their hearts were filled with shame and guilt and fear. They'd rebelled against God's way, and now they had to face the consequences. They tried to hide from God among the trees, but God called them out from their hiding place. God confronted them with what they'd done. And this is what God said to Adam. This is Genesis chapter 2, verse 17. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. The earth, the ground, the environment was cursed because of Adam's sin. The Lord says to him, in pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. You're going to die. And while you live here on this earth, you'll find that it costs you pain to get even food to eat, because you'll be fighting against thorns, thistles, weeds all the time. Instead of creation cooperating with you, it'll be fighting against you. If you want to win bread from the earth, you're going to have to sweat, digging, sowing, watering, reaping, milling the grain, baking it. It's all going to be hard, hard work. Before man sinned, it was as he worked that he received God's good gifts. But the work then was a delight. Now that he had sinned, his work became toil, labor, an imposition. That was God's decree, that it's through work that we gain what we need. And that work is often painful. But built into that then is this assumption, that when we have worked, when we've managed to produce something by the sweat of our brow, we're entitled to call it our own. A man who works, a man who labours, a man who sweats to make something, to produce something, that man is then entitled to say, this is mine. That was there from the beginning. You see it in the next chapter of Genesis. Adam and Eve have two sons, Cain and Abel. They're both workers. They both toil by the sweat of their brow, but they do different work. This is what we read. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. So Abel uses his energy to gather sheep and breed them and lead them to pasture and to doctor them when they're ill and to shear them and to milk them. Cain, on the other hand, is digging, he's ploughing, he's sowing, he's reaping. Now listen, In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. Now notice that word, his flock. It's only the second generation of the human race. But already it's understood that what Abel has worked to produce belongs to him. It's his flock. And what Cain has worked to produce belongs to him. And that is why they can each bring an offering, a gift to God. Abel can only bring sheep as a gift to God because they're his. They belong to him, not to Cain. And Cain can only bring his crops to God, well, because they're his. They're not Abel's. The Lord didn't say, well, actually, the sheep belong to Cain as much as they do to Abel, so I'll count Abel's offering as having come from both of them. Or vice versa with Cain's offering. They'd each worked at the work of their choice. They each had something to show for it. And they were each entitled to say, this is mine. Now that doesn't mean that it would have been wrong for Abel to share what he'd produced with Cain. Or vice versa. That would have been a generous, caring thing to do. But you can only be generous if there's something that in the first place belongs to you by right. Do you understand the big picture that I'm trying to share with you? Human beings are supposed to be God's image bearers. We're supposed to be like God. And one way that that is so is that we're supposed to work as he worked. God has built it into his world that we must work, that unless we work, we will not enjoy his good gifts. That was true before the fall. It's still true after the fall. But now it's part of God's punishment on human sin that that work will often be painful and hard. But God's intention was always that each person should work and that each person should be able to say, what I've gained by my work is mine. That's part of bearing God's image. God claims the earth as his, and now we who are his image bearers can claim what we've worked for. Nowhere in the Bible do you get the idea that all property should be owned by everyone jointly. Cain's crops belong to Cain. Abel's sheep belong to Abel. And as you go through the Bible, that principle is taken for granted everywhere. Listen to this. This is Genesis chapter 13. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and gold, and he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel. And Lot, that's Abraham's nephew, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. Here were two men who had become rich by their labour, their uncle and nephew. But each of them still has the right to own his own property. Lot can't say, that's not fair. Abram's got more than I have. We should pool the lot. We should benefit equally. No, the Bible takes it for granted that it's a good thing that a man who has worked should be able to say that what he's gained from his work belongs to him. Now, let me repeat. That doesn't mean that two people or more than two people should never choose to hold their property in common. The most obvious example of that is a husband and wife. If a man and a woman have a true one flesh relationship, then the man will think of everything he owns as being there for the benefit of his wife. And the wife likewise in relation to her husband. That's something the Bible encourages. And indeed, any group of people may choose to do that. Each of them may choose to say voluntarily, I want to make my property available to the whole group so that it can be used by everyone. There's nothing immoral or ungodly about joint ownership of something. And there's certainly nothing wrong at all with someone who owns something giving freely to someone else. In fact, the Bible encourages people again and again and again to give freely from what they own. Hundreds of times the Bible encourages us to be generous, to give to the needy. But, and this is the central point, unless there is such a thing as a right of property, unless I'm entitled to say, this is mine, giving, generosity, is actually impossible. The only point about giving is that I have something which belongs to me, and yet I'm choosing to deprive myself of it in order to enrich you. So the Bible teaches clearly that there is such a thing as personal property, that a human being can say about something, I own this. I alone have the right to decide what I do with this. Nobody's got the right to take it from me against my will. I may choose to share it. I may choose to give it away. I may choose to lock it away in a vault. But no human being can dictate to me what I do with it. Now, what a man chooses to do with his property may indeed be sinful in the eyes of God. It may be greedy, it may be selfish, it may be wasteful, and God will judge him for that and punish him. But it is still his property. If you want a New Testament passage that makes that point, take the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Remember, they were members of the church in Jerusalem. And there were some very poor people in that church. People who were in great need. And some of the wealthier church members decided to sell off their surplus property so that they could make the money available to help the poor. That was the right thing to do in those circumstances. It's what the Lord Jesus would have wanted them to do. But Ananias and Sapphira weren't willing to do that. Or at least they weren't willing to go as far as some of the others. Yes, they sold off a piece of land. And they handed over some of the money they received to help the poorer church members. But the rest they kept back. They pretended that they had given all the proceeds from the sale, but they hadn't. They lied about it. Well, the Lord knew their hearts. And the Lord revealed to Simon Peter what this couple had done. And Peter questioned them. He asked them, why did you lie? And then he said this, while the land remained unsold, did it not remain your own? Peter says to them, it was yours. It belonged to you. You didn't have to sell it. Nobody would have criticized you if you'd hung on to it. You had the right to sell it or not to sell it as you chose. And then he added this, and after it was sold, was it not at your disposal? When you'd sold off the land and when you had the money in your hands, you didn't have to give that money away. Nobody had the right to tell you you must. It was yours. You had the right to hang on to that money. Your sin isn't that you held back some of the money. Your sin is that you lied about it. The Bible teaches that there is a right of property, that any human being has the right to hold property and say, this is mine. And nobody else has the right to dictate to them what they must do with it. They are accountable to God directly for what they do with it. According to the Bible, as I read it, there are three legitimate ways in which a human being can acquire property. The first is the way we've been talking about. He gains it by his work. whatever that work might be. It might be physical work, it might be intellectual work, it might be work where he's the only person involved, the work of an artist or a sculptor, or he may do it as part of a team, or he may do it as an employee, or it may be that the work he does is supervising other people's work. Maybe the work he does is trading, making products available to people where and when they want them. But one way or another, a man works. He gives physical or intellectual or artistic effort, and he gains something from it. And then he says, what I've gained is mine. Now, of course, that presupposes that the work he's doing is legitimate work, that it's not in itself sinful work. It's done in a legitimate way, that he's not exploiting others. We'll be talking about that at a later point as we think about this eighth commandment. He's not exploiting others. He's not damaging other people. He's not ruining the environment that's been entrusted to him. There are illegitimate ways of working. But if a man is doing legitimate work in a legitimate way, then what he gains by his work, he can rightly say, is his. The second way in which a human being can legitimately acquire property is through inheritance. If I've worked, and if I've gained property, assets through my work, well, those assets are mine. And I can decide what happens to them after my death. So I'm entitled to say, I want them to go to my children. My children haven't worked for them, but they receive them from myself. And again, then they're entitled to say that those assets belong to them. They've got the right to that property. And then the third way is through gift. Again, if I've worked and if I've gained assets, money, property, through my work, or if I've inherited assets, they're mine. So I can then choose to give them to whoever I want to give them to. I'm free to give them to my cousin or my friend or to a stranger whom I meet in the street. And whoever I give them to, he's then entitled to say, well, this is now mine. It belongs now to me. Three ways that we discover in the Bible are legitimate ways of gaining assets, property. Three ways that God has authorized in his word. The man who steals is the man who wants to bypass all of those three. The man who steals is the man who says, I am simply going to take what I've not worked for, and what I've not inherited, and what has not been given to me as a free gift. The man who steals is simply overriding God's pattern. He's attacking the image of God in the end, because it's part of the image of God that we gain through our work, and that then we pass on the gain to those whom we choose to pass it on to. Well, it may seem to you that I've taken a very long way round to approach the commandment, the eighth commandment, you shall not steal. And I accept that. It has been a long way round. But I think it is necessary. You remember I started by talking about Pierre Proudhon. All property is theft. And we talked about the Marxist assumption that ideally everything should be held in common. And I said that those ideas have filtered through into our society at all sorts of levels. Well, we need to be alert. And we need to recognize when people are subtly pushing forward those assumptions that run against what the Bible teaches. We need to watch out for the weasel words. Privilege is one of them. You know, the moment the people in the media or in public eye, start talking about privilege, you be wary. There's a legitimate way to use that word, but there it can also be used as a way of manipulating your thinking. Very often when people use that word, their underlying philosophy is this: no one should have the right to be wealthier than anyone else. If a person has managed to make a lot of money through their legitimate work, it should be taken off them. Or if they've inherited it from their parents or their grandparents, that's unfair and they should be penalised for it. Either it should be taken from them, or at least they should be stopped from using it in the way they choose. So they shouldn't be allowed to buy private healthcare with it. Or they shouldn't be allowed to use it to pay for a tutor for their children. But if you accept what the Bible says, that people have a right to call their property their own, and if they've gained it by legitimate work, or through inheritance, or through somebody else's generosity, then you can't think like that. They have the right to do with it what they choose. They've a right to spend it on the things that they believe important. You see, if you do adopt the proposition that privileged people don't have the right to call their property their own, the next step is you say, so if you feel underprivileged, then you've got the right to take their property away from them. So a young man from an underprivileged background has got the right to break into somebody else's house. He's got the right to steal whatever he can get. What is to be our view of property? The property that God has put into our hands. The property that we've worked for, or the property that we've inherited, or the property that is given to us. What is our view of that property? I can't put it better than the way John Wesley put it. He expressed a truly biblical view of property and money, and he lived by it. He said this firstly, he said, get all you can. And he meant it. Work and work hard and make a profit. Get all the money you can, said Mr. Wesley. And that's what he did. Alongside his preaching work, that was extraordinary, he wrote dozens of books and tracts and other publications. As he was crisscrossing the country on his horse, he'd be writing away, leaving the horse to decide on the route. And the things he wrote sold in great numbers, and he made a profit on them. And he didn't feel ashamed or guilty, because he knew that that money was legitimately earned. It was his to do what he wanted with. Get all you can, he said, and he lived by that rule. And then he said this, save all you can. By which he meant live as economically as you can. It's your money. You're free to do with it whatever you want. But if you want God's approval, don't waste it on luxuries. Don't waste it on unnecessary comforts. Don't waste it keeping up with the Whitfields. Don't use it selfishly. Save all you can. In the year 1731, when he was a young man, he had an annual income of £30. That was enough for a single man to live on. So he lived on £28. When his income had risen to £60 a year, he still lived on £28. When his income had been raised to £90 a year, he still lived on £28. When it was at £120, he still lived on £28 a year. Eventually, he was receiving more than £1,000 a year as the result of his writing. And he was still living on £28 a year. He refused to keep increasing his standard of living with unnecessary luxuries, because he was determined to save all he could. First rule, get all you can. Get all the money you can. Second, save all you can. Live as economically as you can. And then his third rule, give all you can. It's your money. You've earned it. You've saved it. No one's got the right to tell you what to do with it. But Wesley's advice and Wesley's choice was use it in the best way possible. Give it to people who need it. Give it to gospel causes. Give it to the poor. Give it to the vulnerable. Give it to the desperate. They don't have the right to take it from you. That's stealing. But you've got the right to give it. So give all you can. When he was earning £30 a year and living on 28, he was giving away £2. And when he was bringing in more than £1,000 a year, he was still living on £28, and he was giving away all the rest. When he died, he had been earning £1,400 a year. But he said, I've never had more than £100 in hand, because everything else has been given away. He was determined he wouldn't leave even £10 behind him when he died. When he died in 1791, there in his will, he talked about the money he was leaving behind him. But all it was were the coins, the loose coins in his pocket. He left not a penny more. That's a Christian's understanding of property. God has given it to me. He's entrusted it to me. He's given me work to do by which I gained it. Or he's allowed me to inherit it. Or he's moved other people to give it to me. It's mine now. But I'm holding it to be used for him. I'm holding it to be used in the best possible way. We'll go on to talk about this eighth commandment, God willing, not next week, but a fortnight from now. And we'll start trying to think through some of the complicated issues of what is right and what is wrong in our dealings with other people.